You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, August 20th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Jumbo. How's everyone tonight?
How are you, Evan?
Ev, what's up, man?
Good. That's exactly how you say hello in Swahili. I'm glad you asked, Jay. Thank you very much.
Jumbo?
Jumbo.
That's a juice. It's also a juice.
Jumbo juice?
Might be Jumbo.
What do you call a person that speaks Swahili? Swahilian?
It's actually four countries. It's the official language of Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, and Comoros.
And Lieutenant Uhura.
Yeah, so which one did she come from? Beat me to it.
Number of speakers, 60 million people in the world.
Wow, that's a lot of people.
Speak Swahili. That is a lot of people.
I have no segue for what happened in this day in history. No segue at all.
Wow, it finally happened.
Yeah.
Segue challenged.
I'm just going to go for it. On August 25th, 1835, the New York Sun began its series of articles, which came to be known as the Great Moon Hoax. And maybe you are relating that to our current day idea of what a moon hoax is, which is the conspiracy theorist idea that NASA did not actually land on the moon, that it was all faked on a soundstage. Well, this was a moon hoax before moon hoaxing was cool.
Soundstages.
Yeah. This was a series of articles that nobody's sure exactly who penned them, but they've been attributed to Richard A. Locke, a reporter who was working for the Sun at the time. He never admitted to writing it, but all signs seem to point to him. This series of articles were, they described great discoveries found on the moon using a high-powered telescope and were purported to have been discovered by Sir John Herschel, who at the time was one of the most famous astronomers in the country. And the author was one Dr. Andrew Grant, who said that he was the traveling companion of Herschel, but ended up being completely made up out of whole cloth. So these discoveries that they supposedly found on the moon included a man bat frolicking around the moon. Mm-hmm. Lots of fantastical goats and various creatures that don't exist in the real world.
Now we know where the character Batman came from.
Yeah. Bipedal tailless beavers was one. They apparently built temples and there were trees and oceans and beaches.
Beaver
and
temples.
The paper actually never actually issued a retraction. So, I mean, as far as we know, the New York Sun still stands behind these articles. And it wasn't even discovered to be a hoax for several weeks after it was published. And when it was published, it was shown to, or when it was discovered to be a hoax, apparently it was shown to Sir John Herschel, who found it to be quite amusing. But then he ended up getting quite annoyed at all of the dummies who kept they didn't email back then. What did they do before email existed?
They corresponded.
Smoke signals. Carrier
telegraphing. Anyway, a bunch of dummies were always asking him to tell them all about the fantastical creatures he discovered on the moon, and he got fed up with it. And I found an interesting thing on the Wikipedia page about the hoax, which is the potential reason why Locke wrote this. I mean, for starters, it did increase the paper's circulation a great deal. And that circulation apparently never went back down. So it was a bit of a success in that respect. But also, it was suggested that Locke was satirizing certain quote-unquote scientists who were publishing papers claiming to have discovered amazing things, like Franz von Paulo Gruthusen, at Munich University, published a paper called Discovery of Many Distinct Traces of Lunar Inhabitants, Especially of One of Their Colossal Buildings. And the really interesting one that Wikipedia brings up, at least, was one Reverend Thomas Dick, who is known as the Christian Philosopher after the title of his first book. He had computed that the solar system contained 21,891,974,404,480 inhabitants.
Plus or minus one.
481. There's a birth.
Oh my God.
And he said that the moon alone would have, 4.2 billion inhabitants. So.
Wow. Do you know what they call? Steve, do you know what they call moon inhabitants?
Mooninites.
Moonicules.
Lunatics.
Ooh, lunatics.
Cheeseheads.
Like
to justify this apparent discovery, they wrote about a newfangled telescope that was able to see the moon. And then when they ended the hoax, that apparently the telescope, sunlight through the telescope started a fire and burned down the observatory and all the evidence.
Which is an brilliant. Awesome way to end
wow.
a hoax.
Yeah. Speaking of the sun, Bob, I hear that's pretty round.
Oh boy, yeah. Well,
how round is it?
Scientists are yet again baffled, apparently. I've read that in multiple websites. I just love that word. And usually we make fun of that term, but this time they're actually a bit surprised about a recent discovery. And as Steve said, the discovery is that the sun is round. And that's it. That's all I got.
What did they think it was before that?
What do they mean by?
Yeah. Well, it's just the amount of roundness is what we're talking about. That's, of course, it's much more complicated than that, but it's just more round than we expected. It's more round than any models led us to believe. And in fact, it's now considered the most perfectly round natural object that we know of in the universe.
Well, that we've measured.
Well, that's why I said that we know of. The scientists leading the charge in this discovery include Jeff Kuhn, I think he was the primary, Isabel Scholl from the Institute of Astronomy at the University of Hawaii in Manoa, and a bunch of other scientists at other universities. And, this is printed in this week's Journal of Science. And you may think, you know, what the hell took so long to determine how round the sun is and who cares? Well, apart from the knowledge, just for knowledge's sake, which I think is really important, obviously, it's important to know the shape of the sun and track it over time, because even the tiniest changes in the sun's shape could actually affect its brightness, which, of course, would have a downstream effect influencing our weather here on Earth. When it comes to actually determining its exact shape, this is more complicated than you would think. Scientists have been trying for centuries to find out exactly how round the exact shape of the sun, and the biggest problem is the atmosphere. Now, a turbulent atmosphere is almost unavoidable, and of course it makes the stars twinkle, and that's really cool, but it also prevents us from very accurately measuring things, for example, the exact diameter of the sun. So what's the obvious solution, Jay?
They blow it up, and they see, like, if the corona that comes out from that explosion is actually round.
I don't think you could be even more wrong, but the obvious solution is to get above the atmosphere. Get above the atmosphere, right? Just get above it. And that will deal with that problem. And we've done this before, but then you hit another limitation, and that's image resolution. You need these really detailed images if you want to measure the sun with enough accuracy, even if there's no atmosphere in space to distort it. So that's where the NASA's Solar Dynamic Observatory comes in. And we talked about this before, I think. This was launched in 2010, and has some of the best cameras that have ever set its optics on the sun. It's really an amazing device. But even still, you can't just take one picture and done. The SDO actually took 50,000 images over 2 years to get the results that it did. And it had to do this. This is interesting. It had to do this because it had to see the sun in lots of different orientations so that any of the small, imperfections in the satellite's instrumentation would kind of just be like averaged out. And the result that they found, the level of roundness was, I guess, baffling is a good word to put it. If you, every website, of course, has this example. If you shrunk the sun down to 1 meter, say about beach ball size, but if you shrunk it down to that size, the difference in the diameter between, the greatest and smallest diameter that you could measure would only be 17 microns, which is a lot less than the width of a human hair. So it's really, really tiny. So I was thinking, what 17 microns, what does that translate to if you, in real terms, if you scaled up the sun? So I did a few calculations and I came up with 25 kilometers, a 25 kilometer difference, which really is nothing when you think about this, the size of the sun. This is odd because you'd expect the equator to bulge a bit during the 28 day rotation of the sun. And that the Earth does that, right? The shape of the Earth, it's an oblate spheroid. And rather than, which bulges at the equator more so than anywhere else. And,
yeah, but is that just, we have a 24-hour day and the sun's day, if you will, is 28 days?
That could be part of it, but still they, at least at some point, they were expecting that it would not be so perfectly round. So there's four things, and you're right, Steve, that plays into into one possibility. There's four things that could influence how round the sun is gravity and rotation, magnetism and turbulence. And the rotation and gravity have been been discounted. So and I'm not sure how long it took for them to actually discount gravity and rotation, but I don't think this data did that. I think they've known this for a while. The other two possibilities, magnetism was looked into, because you know magnetism is such an immense force on the sun. It's amazing, and it's the reason why we sunspots even exist. That was a possibility as well, but when they did tests on magnetism, they were inconclusive, so they're not quite sure about magnetism. They think it probably not. So now the best possibility looks like is probably the turbulence of the plasma that's underneath the surface. And clearly, since all of our models are saying that the sun should not be perfectly round, it looks like we just don't understand turbulence very well on the sun. And that's one thing.
But Bob, just from gravity, shouldn't the sun be a perfect sphere unless there's something that causes it to deviate from a perfect sphere? Because gravity is going to hold, you know, the gas and plasma or whatever of the sun into a perfect sphere, right?
Yeah, you would think that's the case. But physicists that are a lot more knowledgeable and smarter than I think have thought for decades that it should not be that perfectly round. So I think these other things come into play, like I mentioned, the magnetism and turbulence. It still surprised them. So it's not gravity's. You would think that gravity would be enough to do it, but it's not. It really looks like there's something going on with the turbulence, the turbulence in the plasma under the surface that's just not following them. Our models are not quite right. So this is a great way to find out more about the sun. And the sun always, a lot of these scientists are saying that the sun is always a surprise. It's always throwing a monkey wrench into their theories to a certain extent. Not that their theories are worthless, of course, but it always offers a surprise, which I think is one of the things that makes science so amazing, is that, you know, you never know what to expect. And so in the future, what they want to do is they want to continue observing the sun for the full 11-year solar cycle. And then maybe they'll improve the accuracy even more. And, I assume we'll eventually discover that the sun is even more round than we thought.
Okay. Jay, you're going to tell us about using DNA as a storage medium for computer information, for digital information.
This is a really cool news item. It reminds me of a Star Trek The Next Generation episode. I think this is where I saw it, where a Klingon had some data that they stored inside one of his cells. And then he actually came to the bridge of the Klingon ship and they read the data off of his, I think from a drop of blood or whatever. And I was like thinking about that after watching it, how cool it would be if we could embed our own cells or somehow with information. And now some scientists have actually come up with a way to, at the very least, encode some data inside our DNA using the DNA structure as the encoding device, or at least as the storage medium. And they came up with what they think would be the maximum number of terabytes worth of data that we could store. And Steve, do you know what that number is?
Well, Jay, the scientists were able to store around 700 terabytes in the DNA. I don't think that's the maximum number. That's the actual amount of data that they stored in a strand of DNA.
Yeah, that's pretty mind-blowing. If you think about it, that somebody actually pulled that off. Now, 700 terabytes of data. That's such a vast amount of data that the scientists were saying, or the actual person that wrote the article that I read was talking about the idea, which I found very interesting, that we would be able to eventually record every single thing that happened to all of us ever on video and audio and still have enough storage space to be able to handle that volume of stored information. And I'm sure that
we'd be able to store it. Yeah. But we'd not record it. I mean, but record anything we want to record and then store it.
Yeah. Just as an idea of like how much data storage, like, you know, today, even with the terabyte, the several terabyte drives that we get our hands on and everything, like I'm still managing my data where I don't want to have too much stuff go on. I mean, every time we shoot a video, I'm blowing away a huge chunk of my new big hard drive that I bought. You know, just imagine zero worry about data storage and having multiple copies of your data. You're going to be able to back up all of your data. You're going to carry your data with you.
The problem is read-write speeds.
Well, I mean, in terms of DNA, the purpose of DNA as a storage medium is it's not going to be sitting on your desktop. This is for long-term backup because it takes time to encode the information into DNA. You have to essentially synthesize a DNA strand And then in order to get it out, you have to sequence it, which takes hours.
I'm sure that'll speed up.
It will speed up, but it's never going to be something that sits on your desktop that you're going to use in real time. The advantage of DNA is that it's really stable.
Well, not just that. It's also really small, too. That's the other big advantage.
It's 1 gram, 1 gram of DNA can store 700 terabytes and can be stable over thousands of years. So it's useful in that sort of way. But again, yeah, not for real-time storage that you're going to be using in an actual device.
Well, today they're saying that, but you never know how.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is by any existing technology. You know, 100 years from now, all bets are off. But I mean, they're looking at it now for that kind of archival storage. Archival storage. It would take 233 3-terabyte hard drives to store the same amount of data. That's huge. That's 151 kilograms as opposed to 1 gram.
Gram.
Yeah.
Oof. Yeah. That's the advantage of it.
Hey, Bob, our dreams of a yottabyte world might be taking a little step closer.
That's right. How about that, Bob? Article.
Oh, yeah. It'll happen.
Yeah, so we're not anywhere near the physical limits in terms of storing information with our existing supercomputers. I mean, we have a long way to go. So that's good to know that the potential is there. One more news item before we go on to Who's That Noisy. This is an interesting story. The FDA has been investigating a British producer of homeopathic products for import into the U.S., and they have their standard regulatory stuff that they do. They had to inspect the site and whatnot, and they discovered some very interesting things. They were investigating a company called A. Nelson & Company Limited, and they found a number of violations. So one is not related to the fact that it's homeopathic, but they just found that there was glass on the assembly line that was making its way into pills.
That's bad.
Yeah, it's bad. adequately preventing for, broken glass from vials or whatever, in the process, finding its way into the product. But here's an interesting thing. They found that 1 out of every 6 bottles on the assembly line did not receive a dose of homeopathic drug.
1 out of 6? Did that just make the rest stronger?
How were they able to even detect that?
They made it stronger.
Well, they were dribbling down this outside of the bottle. It wasn't getting delivered into the bottle. They were missed on the assembly line.
Oh, no.
Okay, so it's not like they found it afterwards and, compared one to the other and said, this one looks like it.
No, how could you tell? It's
exactly.
But no, they visually inspecting the containers, 1 out of every 6 on average had the medication got squirted on the outside rather than the inside of the bottle.
All right, so keep going.
The water didn't get its water.
Yeah, but strangely, nobody noticed that 1 in 6 bottles of homeopathic pills from this company never got the quote-unquote active ingredient.
What does that mean?
It is surreal reading reading the report, because it's like they're trying to take themselves seriously, but they're talking about magic potions and nonsense, because there's no active ingredient in homeopathic drugs. They have to call them drugs because that's how they're being regulated. So
it's like having animal abuse department, calling in a unicorn.
Yeah.
Injury reports. Right. Like, what?
So, Steve,
exactly.
I do agree with you. I find it interesting that they actually reported on this. Like, you'd figure they'd just go, fix that thing and just ignore it.
Yeah, it's like they have to pretend that it's real.
Yeah.
And so, pretending that this is all real, then they say, it matters that the magical homeopathic water is not getting into 1 out of every 6 bottles.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Well, that's good, though, because at least that costs them more money. Like, we can take some solace in the fact that having any kind of standards will cost the homeopaths more money.
Yeah.
Right? That's a small
Is it also costing the taxpayer money on any level?
Well, we pay for the FDA to investigate the company.
Yeah.
To do this report. That's true.
Like, do you think that somebody, in a hazmat suit, came up and was like, there's too much of it! It's super condensed.
Yeah, of course. If you were unlucky enough to get one of those bottles, you might overdose.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, God.
Yeah, they wrote in the report, your firm lacked controls to ensure that the active ingredient is delivered to every bottle.
We have a code 7. We have a code 7.
Of course, a lot of people pointed out that, you know, the homeopaths prescribing these pills didn't notice.
Yeah.
You would think that this would have come to light earlier if they actually did things. Then they cited them for not calibrating their instruments often enough.
Right.
So, yeah.
As if that's the problem with homeopathic manufacturing, that their instruments are not properly calibrated. Thank goodness we have the FDA to make sure that the gas chromatographs in homeopathic manufacturing factories are calibrated frequently enough.
Good work, boys.
The last citation was for not properly labeling some of their products. So this is interesting. So homeopathic products can be sold over the counter if they're used for marketed for self-limiting symptoms.
What?
But they have to be labeled as RX only or prescription only if they are marketed to treat an actual disease. So if you say this cures cancer, you have to have RX only on the bottle. If you say this will make you feel better, then you can sell it over the counter. So they had products that were labeled for diseases, that were not labeled as RX only, so they were being sold over the counter instead of RX. Again, it's all magical, useless pills. And so all of this is just going through the motions of pretending that it's real.
Has this law been updated at all? Is 74 years this law? And has there been any tweaking of it?
Nope, not with regard to homeopathy. Not in any significant way that changes the basic thing. So the law in question is the 1938 Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which essentially established the modern FDA. Now, the principal author of this act was Senator Royal S. Copeland from New York, who happened to be a practicing homeopath.
Interesting.
And
conflict of interest.
He put, absolutely. Uh-huh. He put in there the whole, and all homeopathic remedies are automatically approved as drugs by the FDA without any further need of testing. And apparently no one else in the Congress cared or noticed or whatever. You know, this is still 1938. There were still homeopathic hospitals, you know. This is a different time.
Is anybody working to change that?
Yeah, but it comes up every now and then, but it keeps getting squashed by the likes of, you know, Harkin and Hatch and, you know, powerful senators who are enamored of alternative medicine nonsense. Anyway, so that was a complete a surreal thing to read that report. It's like, ignore the man behind the curtain, you know. It's like fantasy time at the FDA.
Yeah, it's
so disgusting.
Is there anyone that works at the FDA that's literally like screaming into a pillow in some office? Like, how can they allow that? How?
Yeah. So, Jay, this is the last week of our Kickstarter video campaign.
That's right, Steve. It ends on September 3rd, but we have a holiday weekend coming up, so this is the last time we're going to mention it on the show before the campaign ends.
You know, we really do want to thank everyone who has supported us so far. We did reach our minimum goal, but we do hope that we'll get some more support in the last week of the campaign. Now, this is more than supporting our web series, Ock the Skeptical Caveman. This is about supporting SGU Video Productions and, of course, the SGU overall. We have many more projects planned than just this one web series. Ock the Skeptical Caveman is intended to be a humorous, entertaining series of short videos that have a skeptical message buried in there. It's intended to be outreach to get people to know about, learn about, and interested in, you know, the skepticism and what we do. Maybe learn a little something from each of the videos. But also, we want to do more hardcore educational videos, like really diving deep on a single skeptical topic, like producing a definitive video reference for that. And we could do that if we get more support. You know, creating videos is very time consuming. It's very expensive. We have no shortage of talent, of ideas, of projects that we want to do. We have people lining up to offer us their technical consultation. We're pulling together a lot of talent and expertise that really want to help us promote skepticism through these videos. But we need your support. We really do. So if you haven't taken a look at it yet, please go to our homepage. You can click through there to the Kickstarter campaign for Ock the Skeptical Caveman. You can see the different levels of support that we offer, and we do offer you a little gift in as a thank you for supporting us. The upper levels are still open, where if you donate enough, you actually can get in one of the videos with us.
Or Steve, remember I added in another layer there where you could, if you don't want to be in the actual episode, you could be a guest rogue on one of our upcoming podcasts.
That's right. But at any level you can afford to support, we would greatly appreciate it. Let's do what we can to put as much skepticism as we can out there. All we're asking is that you just take a moment and take a look at what we've done and give us your support. All right, well, Evan, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy.
Yeah, let's play for you last week's quite popular Who's That Noisy.
It's Simon Kiffin!
I love that.
Yeah, it's a good clip. Loving that clip. That's our buddy, Adam Savage.
Adam Savage.
How epic is that guy? Why does his voice sound all funny like that?
Because he's high.
Because he's low.
Yeah, he's low.
Sulfur hexafluoride is the culprit there. So when, as we've all done at some point in our life, we've inhaled a helium balloon and our voice gets all nice and squeaky, well, sulfur hexafluoride has the exact opposite effect. And it makes our voice lower.
Because it has a lower vibrational frequency than air.
And that's how it works.
Yeah, that was cool. I remember when he first showed us that to us at TAM last year, I think. Oh, man. It was 2 years ago.
A couple years ago.
Maybe more.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, I actually forgot. I forgot about it until Evan played it last week, and then I looked it up again to see what it was. And I kind of rediscovered the whole thing again, which was awesome.
They also have examples on YouTube and other places where you can fill a aquarium-sized device full of sulfur hexafluoride, and you can, like, make little paper boats and stuff and float it on the gas. It's very, very dense.
Yeah, it's cool.
It's cool stuff.
Who got that right? No, a lot of people got that right. Who got it first?
Oh, yeah. Tons of people got that right. Thank you, everyone, for writing in and giving your guesses. We got a ton of correct responses. We're going to give it to Timothy Kersting via email was the correct one. First correct person to guess it. That was Adam Savage. Well done, Timothy.
Good job. And what do you got for this week?
This week, we've got something that's, well, perhaps a little less familiar. Here you go. All right, guys, there you go.
All right, thanks, Evan.
Yeah, give us your best guess. Good luck, everyone.
We have two email questions this week. The first one we got from actually a few people. Here's a typical one. As you all are probably aware by now, GOP Senate candidate and current Congressman Todd Akin said today that in cases of quote-unquote legitimate rape, women's bodies don't allow them to be impregnated. Grassroots conservatives have begun to trot links like this out to support this belief. Could you guys put out an analysis of GOP claims on this issue, a non-supporting study being tossed around in the last few hours? Then he gives another link. Clearly, the real case they're making is more along the lines of pregnancies by rape are in a small enough minority, no one should care about them, as if we don't care about other human healthcare issues in cases of extremely rare infections and diseases that only inflict a small handful of people per year. So we got a number of people writing us in to ask us to take a look at Todd Akin's claims that women who are quote-unquote legitimately raped, whatever that means, rarely get pregnant because their bodies prevent it from happening. Rebecca, you probably have some opinions on this matter.
Oh boy, do I. This just happened and he's already been yelled at by pretty much everyone from both major parties. What he said was, from what I understand from doctors, it, meaning pregnancy from rape, is really rare. If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down. So what he's saying is that women who get pregnant as the result of being raped are most likely weren't really raped. And also some rapes are legitimate and some are not. So an analogous situation would be a senator saying, as I understand scientists, we aren't really related to monkeys. The statement is factually incorrect. They use science to validate it. And it has long been used as one small part of a much larger campaign. This idea didn't just drop out of Akin's mouth out of nowhere. Much like the idea that we aren't related to monkeys, the idea that a raped woman can't conceive goes back quite a long ways, centuries, and was debunked long ago. But it continues to be used by those who want to ban abortion under any circumstances. So We don't really know whether or not he believed what he said, but because this bit of pseudoscience has been floating around for so long, I think we can say with a pretty good degree of certainty that he is not telling the truth when he said in a later statement that he, quote, misspoke. What he said was actually word for word something we've seen said over and over and over again. In fact, Daniel Jacquard and Claude Thomaset wrote in Sexuality and Medicine in the Middle Ages, and I quote, because the female seed was supposedly located within the sexual fluid, female orgasm was believed to be necessary for conception and thus pregnancy. Accordingly, rape victims, prostitutes who no longer enjoyed sexual relations, and women with less than gifted partners could not conceive children. And as an example, a British legal text written in the 13th century has a clause that reads, if, however, the woman should have conceived at the time alleged in the appeal, it abates, for without a woman's consent, she could not conceive. Writer Justine Larbalestier revealed that during her PhD research, she came across this passage in Thomas Lecure's book, Making Sex. Samuel Farr, in the first legal medicine text to be written in English, 1785, argued that, quote, without an excitation of lust or enjoyment in the venereal act, no conception can probably take place, so that if an absolute rape were to be perpetrated, it is not likely she would become pregnant. And absolute rape there doesn't sound all that different from legitimate rape.
Yeah.
But we'll set that aside and move on. You can see how that misconception might actually be good for women in that it might encourage men to, you know, give as well as receive if they want any progeny. But instead, this bit of pseudoscience was used as a way to prove that rape victims were asking for it, basically, if they ended up getting pregnant, that allowed the rapist to walk away scot-free.
Do you think that's a part of a bigger tendency? It seems like, you know, I know psychologists have described this, that there's a tendency to want to blame rape victims. You know, like they were asking for it, they were being seductive or whatever, for whatever reason. I mean, I don't know why some people find that that's less abhorrent to think about. And I guess a rape victim that gets pregnant is, I mean, that's like a double whammy. You know, that's a double crime against that woman. So, you know, that causes some kind of cognitive dissonance that people want to ameliorate by saying, well, okay, maybe she, you know, was willing or consensual and that's why she got pregnant. So I don't have to think about this horrible thing happening.
Yeah. I mean, you'd think that pregnancy would be the ultimate evidence in a rape case, evidence in favor of the victim. But yeah, you're right. In this case, it's been used against the woman as a way to imply that she was asking for it. I mean, it wasn't even until the 1980s that marital rape was considered a thing. You know, prior to that, legally, a wife could not be raped by her husband. And in fact, there was legislation that Aiken opposed. It would create a law that would say that marital rape is a crime. He opposed it at first because he was afraid that it would be used in divorce proceedings to hurt men. And it wasn't until there was an outcry that he ended up signing on and the legislation passed. He's putting forth this idea that the only way you can actually be raped is if you're violently raped. Forcible rape is another term that Aiken himself has used in legislation in the past, until outcry, of course. So yeah, and Aiken isn't the only contemporary politician to use this bit of pseudoscience. It's been happening at least since the 80s quite often. The Atlantic collected a number of them, including this gem, which was originally found by BuzzFeed's Anna North. This comes from Representative Stephen Freund in Pennsylvania in 1988, who said that the reason why rape victims don't get pregnant is because the traumatic experience of rape causes a woman to secrete a certain secretion that tends to kill sperm. Yes.
What? Right, yeah.
So,
where did this go? What?
Yeah. So this has been going on for quite a while.
Making things up.
I think he pulled that secretion out of his ass.
Yeah, literally.
So, you know, maybe it goes without saying, but we'll say it anyway. All of this flies in the face of the actual science that we have. Pregnancy resulting from rape is not a rare occurrence. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists reports that there may be around 32,000 rape-related pregnancies annually among adult women in America. And there have been plenty more studies that show that rape-related pregnancy is anything but rare. One study found a rape-related pregnancy rate of 5%. I found another study saying more like 8%. Some studies show rape-related pregnancies have a higher rate of pregnancy. Some actually do show a slightly lower rate of pregnancy. But the main factor in determining differences between rape-related and non-rape-related pregnancy rates seems to be simply the use of contraception. Women who are assaulted don't have access to it. And thus, for most of these studies, it appears that they're more likely to experience a pregnancy. The stress of the rape does not appear to have any impact on the pregnancy. So what we have here is a long debunked bit of pseudoscience that, much like creationist canards that we talk about all the time, is a lie that's just used to justify the end goals of religious fundamentalists.
Now, Rebecca, you didn't mention Physicians for Life.
I did not. No.
Which is a group of physicians who are essentially using their status as professionals, medical professionals, to argue, against abortion, for example, to take a pro-life position. And they have an article on their website that says assault rape pregnancies are rare. So they are supporting this notion that if you are forced rape or assault rape, which again, they make that distinction, I guess that's where the notion of legitimate rape came from, that for whatever reason the woman's body inhibits the implantation and the fertilization, et cetera, the necessary steps to becoming pregnant. So this idea is out there in the pro-life culture and is being supported by this particular group of physicians who are, essentially spreading anti-scientific notions in order to support their ideological position.
Yeah. And this is another way that it's entirely analogous to creationist propaganda because, creationists seek out anybody with a PhD pretty much, but particularly anyone in the sciences that will sign on and say that evolution is bunk. And they actually have those people. This is the same people that suggest that abortion causes depression and breast cancer, things that we've mentioned in the past on the show that have been thoroughly debunked.
On the article in question, they have three references backing up their statement that rape pregnancy is rare, none of which establish their premise. So it's the old fake references ploy, where you have references that have titles which kind of sound like they're sort of about that topic, but if you read the actual article, which they're basically just counting that people aren't going to click through and read the original research, it doesn't support what they're linking to, what they're referencing them for. It's classic pseudoscience.
Agenda.
Yeah, they're
yeah.
Agenda. All right, well, Evan, we're going to end up with a quickie email. You're going to talk about this one. This one comes from Agnes Leck Noonenkamp. I probably didn't pronounce that correctly. Sorry, Agnes. She writes, "Hi, guys. Love the show. Have you seen this? It caught my attention because you have discussed the sale of magic spells on one of your shows." And she links to a article on about eBay. And she says, "Keep up the excellent work." So, Evan, what is going on at eBay with magic spells?
Well, I can read it right off of eBay's website in their own words. And it says the following. Category eliminations. Due to a large number of misclassified items and eBay policy violations, some categories will no longer be available on eBay starting the first week of September. Starting on August 30th, 2012, attempts to list items in these categories will be blocked. The following items are also being added to the prohibited items list. So here we go. Here's the list. Advice, spells, curses, hexing, conjuring, magic, prayers, blessing services, magic potions, healing sessions, work from home businesses and information, wholesale lists, and drop shop lists. So, what they're telling us is that we can no longer peddle our hexes, curses, spells, other fairy dust, and other so-called magical things.
What about incantations?
Didn't quite exactly say that. I imagine if you hired a lawyer, they could get you through
that technicality.
What about voodoo? But voodoo? No. Voodoo is right out.
Okay.
Voodoo is right out. But you're allowed to still hawk your wares as far as things like, dowsing rods or Ouija boards or crystals and pendulums and other.
So magic is out, but pseudoscience is still in.
Pseudoscience is still rife throughout eBay. And I know we've commented on before. We've blogged about it before. We've done little video presentations. Rebecca, I know you've done at least one about this, and eBay continues to allow purveyors of, nonsense to slip through the cracks here.
Well, I didn't just make a video on it. I actually sold a spell.
Cool.
A witch, burn her.
Someone,
you know she's a witch.
This was actually 2 years ago. Someone tipped me off to the fact that eBay was full of spells. And like you literally you won nothing. You were bidding on someone doing a magical incantation to, for instance, change your brown eyes blue or making someone fall in love with you. Which, you know, brings us back to rape. Come on. Like that is, that's just magic rape.
That's ridiculous. Magic rape. Get
exactly.
Out. Continue.
Making someone fall in love with you. That's messed up. So,
legitimate magic rape.
Yeah, legitimate.
Right. Everyone knows the big book of fairies strictly prohibits using fairy magic to make somebody fall in love with you.
Exactly. What is wrong with you, Steve?
Or else they'll turn you into a newt.
It's also against the genie code. It's a strong tradition within, you know, magical lore that magical creatures that grant wishes cannot make someone fall in love with you.
That's good. I think that's responsible of the magical creatures.
They even had it in Disney's Aladdin.
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
And Fairly Odd Parents. Those are my two references.
References. Those are solid. Those are legitimate, Steve.
They are legitimate references. Don't check them out, but they're legitimate.
So I placed my own magical spell for sale, and it was a body modification spell. I just basically ripped it off of one of the other sellers, only I made mine a lot more entertaining.
I'm sure. Stole the idea. Nice.
So how long do we have to sell these spells now?
You're done as of the end of August. August 30th is it.
I think the bottom line was that they were tired of trying to resolve certain disputes. I mean, how do you resolve this kind of a dispute?
Right.
It's not like, oh, I didn't get my pretty pony in the mail. It's like, oh, my eyes didn't turn blue. I didn't fall in love with that, whatever. I think it was purely pragmatic from their point of view and had nothing to do with highfalutin skepticism.
eBay spokeswoman Johanna Hoff said that buyers and sellers have complained to eBay that such transactions often result in issues that can be difficult to resolve. So yeah, not so much the skeptic angle, more or less the we don't want to deal with your BS in arguing and go play in someone else's sandbox, which apparently Craigslist and other sites are willing to definitely take up this kind of slack. So don't worry, everyone out there who wants to buy, you know, your love potions and whatever else, you'll find it elsewhere.
There are plenty of marketplaces for nonsense. They don't need eBay too. We are at TAM 2012, and we're sitting down now with Chris Ford from Pixar. Chris, welcome to the Skeptics Guide.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You were kind enough to actually give us a tour of Pixar a few days ago, and we all loved it. It was a blast. It was just awesome. And the stuff you had to tell us about the process and the technology that Pixar uses, you know, to make their animated films, I thought was fascinating, and you agreed to come on the show to talk about it. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your position at Pixar, and then we'll get into some of that stuff.
Yeah, so I am part of the RenderMan team at Pixar. That's the team that develops the software that is used to create the images in our films. So the final images you see, all the lighting, the texturing, all of that essentially comes from a very sophisticated software program that isn't only used in our own films, but is also used in the bulk of the visual effects industry. And that's actually one of the aspects of Pixar that is probably less well known. You think of us as a feature film studio, and of course we are, but Pixar also essentially pioneered much of the basic image rendering technology that essentially has been responsible for the modern revolution in visual effects since, well, Jurassic Park and Toy Story in the early 90s. So I'm very much, if you like, in the background, and I'm personally responsible for kind of managing those relationships that the studio has with other users of RenderMan as much as what the studio does itself.
Do you lease out the software that you create for the movies, or do you just sell them outright, or how does that work?
We do both, actually. But yes, we actually sell our software to other studios, but we also supply time. And it's interesting that the landscape is changing at the moment. The cloud, for example, is a pretty significant development in the way that in future studios and you know, medium-sized boutique studios, if you like, and even individual users will be able to access the level of image rendering technology which, you know, you normally associate with large-scale movies.
Now, the software that you create, I'm wondering, what do you do? So you just finished a movie, Brave, and I assume that you created lots of new software, like for hair and stuff. So right. I'm sure you're relying on a lot of the old software you created for the other movies, but how much is new software that's created just for the specific movie that you're on to deal with a specific technical challenge, like curly hair, for example?
Right. So, I mean, there is a heritage, if you like, of software tools that has developed over the time. And you actually often see this in the movies themselves. In fact, there are specific milestones in the development of certain techniques I can tie down to very specific Pixar movies. Think of Toy Story, the original movie. Great story. You can watch it, and everything holds up. And everything's made of plastic. And why is that? That's all we could do back at the time. By the time you get to Monsters, you know, you want something a bit more interesting than plastic, so you have a furry creature, Sully, but he's the only furry creature in the movie because that was really all we could do. By the time, of course, we get to Ratatouille, you know, the whole movie is full of furry creatures. The lighting effects in Nemo, for example, are another example of, if you like, just a movie that's associated with a certain type of look development. In fact, look development is the term used to describe how unique style is associated with a character or, you know, the overall look of the film itself. So, you know, take hair, for example. You know, and in Brave, they have this amazing tangled red hair of Merida, the main character. You know, the techniques which are used to do that have been in existence for some time, but definitely we push the state of the art in creating that very kind of straggly look. You know, where there are digital styling tools, you know, curling irons, if you like, that can be used to actually create a very disheveled look at times. And the soft body collisions, which essentially govern the physical interaction of the various hair elements, all of these are being computed as a simulation for the movie. And then they're all rendered to give you that kind of look you see in the film. The rendering techniques use methods like deep shadows. You know, the names describe what they are that create that very kind of three-dimensional and realistic look. But, you know, rendering hair is a different type of problem to rendering skin, which is different to rendering, you know, a wall or a grass. You know, all of these use basic techniques that are essentially built on a foundation of software that has been in development for, you know, several decades now.
So what comes first? When you mentioned, and it was really interesting to hear you say that, as you scroll through the movies, you know, you picked, in Toy Story, you picked plastic, and that inspired the creators of the story to say, okay, what can we handle? Like, what can we handle graphically? Is that what
you
were saying?
I think it'd be true to say that the director of any film will want to push the technology as far as he can. And in fact, that is what normally happens. You know, a director will say, I want this type of look, and that really inspires us to try to figure out how to do it. Mm-hmm. And it's not always easy.
But
right?
It does go both ways, though. So, like, maybe the writers or the director, or, you know, I'm not sure about the process at Pixar, but at some point the technology has to be able to complement and match the story.
Yeah, actually, John Lasseter, who was the director of the original Toy Story movie and, of course, of Cars and Toy Story 2, actually has a saying which I think summarizes that perfectly, which essentially is that the art inspires the technology and the technology in turn creates the art. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of a synergy. It is a circular process.
Right. But you were writing to the technology when you decided we're going to do a movie about plastic toys or even cars and or insects, you know, things like that. You were writing within the limits of the technology to some extent, right?
Ultimately, yes. I mean, certain things are possible at certain times of development process. You know, you must remember that a typical feature film, 90 minutes, 100 minutes long, at 24 frames a second, is going to be like 130,000, 140,000 frames, and each of those frames can take hours each to compute. Now, the bar rises each movie, right? You know, the amount of stuff, if you like, visual information you can fit in each of those pixels continues to rise, as does the computing power underneath it, you know, following Moore's law. But ultimately, you need to get a film out of the door to schedule. And so the basic methods and techniques that are used obviously have to reflect the underlying reality of the computing performance available at the time the film is made. There's actually a very interesting development in the way that images are being created at this point. Traditionally, rendering, again, the look you associate with the final product on the film, has used essentially methods that approximate real life. You know, they're a cheat, in other words. You know, you're looking at a flat screen, you're looking at a rasterized image, you're looking at scan lines. It's not necessarily how the physics and optics of light work, but the methods of actually simulating how light really works have, you know, been known and have been coded as algorithms for quite a few decades. But only now has the computing power become accessible to make these methods usable in feature films. So we're now seeing lighting using more physically accurate, or at least physically plausible methods of lighting becoming more common because the compute power has now caught up mm-hmm. with what the algorithms can do.
And Chris, you said during our tour that as the technology has increased, as CPU power has increased, it still takes about the same amount of time per cell, right?
Right.
Because you're continuing to add more complexity to each one. So 5-10 years ago, when you were making a movie, there's less information and the CPUs weren't as powerful. So it's just staying at par so that the amount of time it takes you to actually create each frame is still the same, even though you're putting a lot more into each one.
Right. Yeah, and I've tracked this very precisely. First of all, there is a basic law in high-level or high-end computer graphics called Blinn's Law, named after Jim Blinn, who was one of the pioneers of computer graphics. You may remember back in 1979, the Voyager space mission had this animation associated with it of the spacecraft moving past Jupiter and Saturn. Jim did that. He's now a researcher at Microsoft. But he coined Blinn's Law, which essentially is a variation of the principle that work expands to fill the space available. In this case, you know, a frame will always take a certain amount of time given the resources you have. Now, around about, I think it was about, 4 or 5 years ago during Cars, the original movie, it was someone worked out on a kind of rough sheet of paper or back of an envelope how much computing power would be needed to do that compared with the amount of computing power available at the time of Toy Story, the original movie. And it turned out that it was a 300 or more fold increase. In fact, I think we'd had to have started rendering back in the time of ancient Greece or thereabouts if we'd had the compute resources available at the time. So the data centers or the render farms that are used to create these movies, they have generally been growing at a compounded rate of about 30% year over year. Underneath all of that, we're seeing the basic processor architectures grow from single processors to dual core to quad core to dual quads. You know, in fact, there's so much processing capacity available now that, as I mentioned earlier, it's now becoming possible to produce more physically plausible or physically accurate lighting models than was the case in the past. And we look at this trajectory from 1993 or thereabouts, which is really when the modern visual effects revolution occurred with Toy Story and Jurassic Park, through to 2012, right? So, a period of, 17 years. We just extrapolate how far we've come and how far we might go and how fast computers are becoming and how distributed that capacity is becoming in the cloud and will do in the cloud as well. It's a pretty exciting time in this business.
You spoke about the improvement in technology, like first, rendering plastic-like figures and then moving on to hair. And I definitely noticed in Pixar movies there's more and more people.
Absolutely.
Because they're obviously challenging. But the people are cartoony in some way. They're not photorealistic. But that seems to be, at least the technology is getting to the point where we're able to portray people in a more and more realistic way. Obviously, for artistic reasons, you may choose to not do that. And again, when we were on the tour, we talked briefly, and I'd like to get into a little bit deeper, about the uncanny valley and using computer generated graphics in order to try to realistically portray humans and the limitations in that. So to what extent is Pixar moving in that direction, or is that even not on the radar yet, and how far do you think we are away from photorealistic humans that somebody watching the screen doesn't know it's not an actor in front of a camera?
Right. So it's actually an interesting paradox that Pixar produces this photorealistic rendering technology, RenderMan, sometimes called photorealistic RenderMan, and nothing Pixar does is photorealistic. Everything is stylized or follows this visual look and style of the movie. And you notice that each of our films has a very distinct feel and look. The Incredibles has kind of got a comic book feel. If you look at Ratatouille, it has a very painted kind of impressionistic look almost. You look at all the green, foliage and the colors inside Brave. All very distinct styles. An abstracted realism, I would call it, which serves the need of the story and the mood and, the character of the film and what the director wants to convey. But of course, that same technology is used to produce photorealistic images in visual effects and has to be at such a high level of quality that it can be combined with live action in a very seamless way. And if you look back to maybe just 8 years ago, you know, you look at a CG visual effect and your reaction might be, that's CG.
Right, yeah.
And now it's really hard to tell. You know, I've got a good eye for these things. I actually find it really hard to tell where the seams and the joins are. So in terms of the look of the image itself and the realism of an image, we're pretty much there at this point. But we're now getting into the domain of problems that aren't just problems associated with imagery, but also problems associated with motion and in character and emotion and how you convey that. And this really gets us to fully digital characters and synthetic actors, you know, long a goal of computer graphics. You know, reality is this problem is solved for characters in the distance or in the medium distance from the cameras. You know, we've all seen big armies of orcs or, you know, soldiers or whatever, you know, fighting using crowd simulation control software. That's no problem. That's addressed. As soon as you get very close up, it's getting pretty difficult because, of course, all of us are trained to look at each other from childhood and we immediately spot it if something is not quite right. And what is that thing that isn't quite right? It's often very elusive, but you're aware of it. So I could reference you images of human beings, which are still images that look totally photoreal. They're totally synthetic, but they're completely real. You can find them on the internet, just Google some. As soon as you animate them, something isn't there.
Right.
Now, when asked that question in the past, I used to say it's like 5 years away, and it was always a rolling 5 years.
We're familiar with that.
I actually don't think it's that pessimistic anymore. I think that this actually is now possible. Certainly one movie, Benjamin Button, you know, was a notable example of using photorealistic synthetic humans, in this case Brad Pitt, made to look very old, and did it very effectively. But of course, there was a big budget associated with that. But the technology continues to evolve, so I think that this is becoming now more feasible. Reality is it's very expensive to do it. You know, there are a lot of unemployed actors who are working in restaurants in LA who are a lot cheaper, frankly, at this stage. But you want to do something particularly nasty or gruesome to that actor, then obviously that's where CG effects come in. So this is possible now, but I don't want to underestimate the difficulty of doing this. So there are also very interesting intellectual property issues associated with digital characters, such as, you know, what if you were to resurrect actors who are dead, who don't exist, you know, or do things that are inappropriate for the style of that actor's performance. You know, that actor obviously has relatives, he has an estate, or even agents. You know, there are lawyers who look after, you know, the copyright and the imagery of deceased actors. So
how long does that last, by the way? Is there
I'm not sure, to be honest. I'm not sure, but
could you have George Washington running around doing
something? I'm sure you're fine for someone who is like out of living memory.
Yeah, there is some limitation, 50 years, but you don't know what it is.
I don't know what it is off the top of my head, but certainly someone more recent, you know, that is a minefield. But it does raise, right, a very interesting possibility. You know, what if you could simulate historic characters? You know, just one of the directions that technology developed for the movies could be possibly repurposed in other areas.
Oh, yeah.
For good purposes, not evil purposes, hopefully.
Oh, I'm sure there'll always be someone who can find an evil purpose for this.
Chris, what do you think it would take to, what would be instrumental in getting out of the Uncanny Valley? Would we need some sort of physics-based software that would take into account musculature and nerves and everything like that? Or would it be some sort of really super dense motion tracking that's got...
We should explain very quickly what the Uncanny
Valley is. Billions of points of data. Or what do you think it's going to take to get out of that?
Yeah, and so let me explain, you know, the Uncanny Valley to any listeners who are unfamiliar with it. You know, it essentially comes out of a theory in robotics that you can create, if you like, simulations of humans or avatars of humans that as soon as they become almost real but not quite, your reaction to them changes from one of acceptance to revulsion.
It's kind of like an animated corpse in a sense.
Yeah, essentially. So if you were to graph it, which is where the actual term comes from, you know, you got like a basic, you know, crude robot or an alien or something where your sense of belief has already been suspended. You kind of accept it. But as soon as you try to make it human, and then there comes a point when the graph drops down into the valley.
Sure.
And the only way to get back out of that valley is to make it so real that you can't tell the difference. So bridging that valley is the big challenge. And, you know, you've seen this in some movies that have tried to simulate fairly realistic-looking actors, you know, not stylized like in a Pixar movie, but, you know, actors that essentially are driven by motion capture.
Polar Express. Classic example.
Yeah, I mean, a Polar Express is an example where they've tried to produce digital actors, you know, and, you know, a lot of effort went into that movie, mm. you know, and all credit to them for pushing the state of the art. And it's difficult, you know, certainly there were some comments, you know, that the eyes are difficult, that sometimes there's some feeling you have which is kind of hard to relate to. And that is a classic case of the uncanny valley. So how do you get out of that? You know, you might think that motion capture, you know, the fact that you can cover a face or an actor with sensors and literally use their motion, sampled motion, to drive the computer model is the way out of it. It doesn't quite work that way. You know, we are analog beings. We're not sampled beings. And often it's what isn't there that is as important as what it is you capture. You know, we all have these little tics and mannerisms and mm-hmm. other things we do. We don't even think about at a very subconscious and non-kind of verbal level, but they're all part of what makes us, you know, relatable humans as we talk to each other. So, you know, these things can be addressed, but again, they're difficult and they're expensive to do at the moment.
We're very good at seeing anomalies in physics as well. Like when you're animating something and it doesn't fall correctly or doesn't move correctly because of gravity or something, I find that it's very easy to pick those things out. Like even in a part of the movie you're not particularly looking at, you could be looking on the left-hand side and something happens and it draws your attention very quickly because it just doesn't feel right. And it's the same thing like what you're saying about human faces. We're just so hardwired to read human faces and to recognize human faces that when something is a little off, it might as well be blaring a horn in your face. It's super obvious.
I mean, frankly, I would say that physics is easy compared to humans. Far more complex. I mean, the algorithms and the applications to simulate physics in terms of, you know, objects falling, explosions, water, you know, cloth, fabric, all of these physical effects, which, by the way, are a clearly defined subset of production work inside of any feature film, usually known as physics or simulation, all that is based on reproducible physical principles, right? Mm-hmm. And we know what happens, and we can check it. Humans?
Yeah.
They're a whole different category.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, thanks for sitting down with us. This has been fascinating. And we love Pixar. Thanks again for giving us the tour.
Well, let me thank you. We actually at Pixar have you know, many groups with diverse interests, and we have a skeptics group at Pixar. We listen to you guys. I've been listening to you since Perry was on the show.
Wow.
And so we appreciate what you do.
Thanks,
thank
Chris.
You.
Good
thank
to know
you.
There are skeptics at Pixar.
That gives
me the warm fuzzies for some reason.
Yeah. Makes me want to giggle.
Yeah. Love it. Thank you so much, Chris.
My pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yep.
Of course. We have another classic science or fiction. Three items, no theme. Ready?
Good.
Okay, item number one. Astronomers have discovered the first evidence of a planet being devoured by its aging star. Item number two, a new study demonstrates that peanut butter can be used as an effective oil dispersant for large environmental oil spills. And item number three, researchers find that artificial platelet-like nanoparticles nearly double survival after severe trauma with internal bleeding. Rebecca, go first.
But I don't know any of those.
But we missed you last week.
Yeah, just because you weren't here last week, so I got to get you back in the swing of things.
A planet, I have no idea. A planet being devoured by its aging star. I used to think that the Earth would be consumed by the sun, but then Phil Plait pointed out to me that there's more of a chance that the sun will push the Earth further and further and further away. So that probably wouldn't happen. That's the only fact I know about that. Peanut butter can be used as an effective oil disbursement. That's weird because, I mean, peanut butter is oily. Why not just use peanut oil? Like, what else is in? It's peanuts, some sugar. I don't know. I'm trying to think of how that would work. Like, maybe the peanut part can absorb it while the oily part would help push it away and disperse it. I don't know. But I like the idea because I like delicious solutions to natural disasters. Okay, so artificial platelet-like nanoparticles nearly double survival after severe trauma with internal bleeding. This is my problem with nano anything, is that, yeah, probably. Probably, Steve. Someone has probably...
just means they're really small.
I know, but whenever you put nano in a thing, the answer is probably. So if you say, could nano blah 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 fix blah 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 within 10 years, the answer is probably, yes.
Didn't Perry always say that anything that Steve uses that has nano in it is not fiction?
Okay, so I'm going to GWP.
That's appropriate.
Science, which brings us peanut butter versus planet. So evidence of a planet being devoured by its aging star seems reasonable and yet maybe too reasonable. So therefore, that's probably the fiction.
Okay.
That's what I'm going to go with.
All right, Evan?
I don't know. I have no idea.
First evidence of a planet being devoured by its aging star. If this one is true, I'm kind of surprised that this is the first evidence of it. I mean, don't we know that stars devour some of their planets, at least the ones that are close in? So I think we've known this for a while, but maybe this is the first direct evidence. So that could be possible. Peanut butter, an effective oil dispersant. Interesting. For large environmental oil spills. So that's a lot of peanut butter because there are some pretty large environmental oil spills and, you know, you would have to churn out a lot of peanut butter to do it. But that doesn't mean it's not possible. I'm not sure how practical it is, delicious though it may be. The last one, artificial platelet-like nanoparticles, but double survival. Wow, that's an impressive statistic. You can double the survival after severe trauma with internal bleeding. I'll say that the first evidence of a planet being devoured by its aging star is the fiction, because I don't think it's the first evidence we've had. That's why.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, man, I don't have that much of a problem with the planet evidence of the planet being devoured. I haven't heard anything about any prior evidence if this is true, so I don't have a problem with that. And I could totally, I mean, we've discovered so many planets, I could see, you know, looking back again at a planet and saying, oh, the planet's gone, and oh, look at the star. It's into its red giant phase, I guess, is one option. If it was close enough, I'm sure that the dissipating mass of the sun, wouldn't happen enough for the planet to escape. So I guess that's fairly reasonable, more so than these other guys in 2 and 3. Number two, the peanut butter being used as an effective oil dispersant. I'm horrified at the prospect of this being true. You know, using peanut butter in any capacity that does not involve humans eating it, or especially me eating it, I think should be against the law. I mean, what would that do to the price of peanut butter? I mean, it could be really bad. So I'm not liking that one. The artificial platelets. Yeah, I might do a GWP with this one. I mean, I just don't know enough about platelets. So I'm going to shoosh. I'll say that one's science, and I'll just have to go with the peanut butter being fiction. It's just too scary to contemplate.
Okay, Jay. At some point, some planet had to be devoured by its aging star. It's just that, can we see it? Could we see it? And is there a planet close enough that we could actually see some evidence? And I think the answer to that is most likely. Sure, there might be some telltale signs that this took place somewhere. Just to what degree we could see it, I have no idea. The next one about the peanut butter can be used as a dispersant. I kind of agree with Bob about it's a horrible waste. But then again, you'd think, you know, then they would just grow more peanuts, which is pretty good. The last one, the artificial planet-like nanoparticles that can help internal bleeding. I'm just going to agree with that one and say the peanut butter one is the fake.
Okay. So you all agree with number three. Researchers find that artificial platelet-like nanoparticles nearly double survival after severe trauma with internal bleeding. You all think that Perry is speaking prophetically from the grave about that one, and that anything nano is science. And that one is science.
Oh.
Yay.
Yes, Perry!
Now we can auction off Perry's talking on eBay or whatever he said.
Yeah.
We can share that wisdom with everyone for a price.
That's pretty awesome, Steve. How does it work?
Well, I'll tell you. They have these platelet-like nanoparticles.
And here we go.
They're literally just little artificial platelets.
You know, hey,
I think the use of the word nano is a little bit gratuitous here just because they're very tiny. But they're made of biodegradable polymers. And they did a rat study where they injected them. They essentially traumatized the rats. Then they, And then they injected them with these, with either saline or these polymers, these platelet-like nanoparticles. Platelets are the blood products that clump together and are like the first line of defense against bleeding. The fibrinogen is the second, you know, line of defense. So first the platelets just sort of stick to any cuts and plug up the hole. And then the proteins come in that can actually really like bind the blood up and more permanently clot it off so that then the tissue has a chance to repair itself. What they found was that what the rats that got the fake platelets, that they got incorporated in with the real platelets into the blood clotting and that they made the clots bigger and that they were just as firm and stable as normal platelets, and they helped block the bleeding. So there was less bleeding, and the survival went from 80% with the platelets to 47% without the platelets.
Okay. Oh, wow, man. That's awesome.
Okay, cool.
That's incredible. That's,
yeah.
Steve, that sounds like something that should fairly easily, you know, scale up to humans. You know, and
absolutely.
I know there's no, right? I mean, it sounds like, well, that should work.
Yeah, and the rats apparently suffered no ill effects, even weeks later.
Oh, my God.
So this would be something that would be very useful, obviously, in ambulances, emergency rooms, on the battlefield, any place where, you know, you're likely to be treating acute massive trauma. We have things to help people stop bleeding externally, tourniquets and pressure devices that will stop the bleeding, but nothing for internal bleeding. You have to get them to the OR, basically. But this could do that. It's good to help, you know, stem the amount of blood loss from severe trauma with internal bleeding and give you time to get people to the operating room, basically. So, yeah, this could be a very simple but effective approach. All right.
Go to one.
So is it planet or peanut? We'll go to number one. Astronomers have discovered the first evidence of a planet being devoured by its aging star.
Oh, boy.
Rebecca and Evan think this one is the fiction. Jay and Bob think this one is science. And this one is science.
Dang it. Jay.
I warned
High
you,
five,
Evan.
Jay.
I warned you.
She did warn you.
She did warn me, but I don't know.
Good job, Bob.
It does happen that when stars go into their red giant phase, that they may consume planets that are in the inner solar system, interstellar system. But it would be a very rare event for astronomers to actually catch that in process, because it probably happens fairly quickly. Once the orbit becomes unstable, it might just spiral right in. So this is a stellar system around which we have discovered exoplanets. So in this one stellar system, the giant star is BD+48740. And they found two things, two lines of evidence. And so this is not proof that it happened, but there's two lines of evidence that they say could be explained by the star consuming a planet that's now no longer there to be detected. One is that there was a spike in the lithium content of the planet, of the star. Stars consume lithium. So an old star, like this red giant, really shouldn't have much lithium left. But a spike in lithium could be explained by it consuming a planet. They said that, yeah, lithium production was triggered by a mass the size of a planet that spiraled, oh, there's the world's planet, that spiraled into the star and heated it up while the star was digesting it. The second piece of evidence was that there is another large planet in that system, 1.6 times the mass of Jupiter, that's in a highly elliptical orbit. In fact, the most highly elliptical orbit of any exoplanet that they've seen. And they said that this is unusual because such a highly elliptical orbit would be unstable and wouldn't have survived for so long, you know, to be around. You wouldn't see a highly elliptical orbit around an old star. Said, however, if the planet that got eaten up interacted with this planet, maybe it was getting pushed away and then interacted with this other Jovian planet, and then that caused it to spiral in and also caused the other planet to go into a highly elliptical orbit. That's what they're thinking.
Well, shit. I mean, I wonder how big that original planet that got eaten was. I mean, to have an effect on a Jovian 1.6 times the mass of Jupiter? I mean, that's...
Well, it was probably another gas giant. Yeah, so still a little speculative, but those are the lines of evidence that they have, and it seems like a reasonable hypothesis. All right, well, let's move on to...
Which means?
Number two, a new study demonstrates that peanut butter can be used as an effective oil dispersant for large environmental oil spills. That one is the fiction.
Should have known Bob was going to go with
Good
this.
Good job, Bob and Jay. Now, did anyone read the story that this is based on?
No, did not.
Here's the title. New oil spill dispersant made from ingredients in peanut butter, chocolate, and ice cream.
Okay, it is still delicious.
It is still delicious, Rebecca, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought Bob would be like, oh, peanut butter, chocolate, and ice cream. Doesn't get better than that.
Right? How'd you miss this, Bob?
Actually, yeah, those three go together better than almost.
But these are just, you know,
don't
ingredients.
You get Google alerts for those?
Ingredients that they took from these things and had to combine them together into this other.
Hey, that's almost kind of what I said before I went.
Biodegradable thing. So it's not peanut butter. They're not using peanut butter. It's just something that they derived from it. They won't say what it is. I guess it's like a secret. They had to go
secret.
Through thousands of ingredients, they said, until they hit, like in some kind of computer simulation, until they hit upon this combination. Now, the advantages, they say, to this as an oil dispersant, one is that it could be mass produced. It not only disperses the oil, it would keep the oil from sticking to animals and, you know, birds and wildlife and stuff. And if the animals eat it, it won't kill them. Whereas a lot of birds die, for example, by licking the oil off of their feathers. And it won't compromise the bird's natural waterproofing on their feathers, which existing detergent-based oil dispersants do. So then the birds get waterlogged and they get hypothermic and they die from that. So if this pans out, that would be a huge advance. You know, something that could be cost-effectively mass-produced. You can keep it on hand. It's biodegradable. It's made from, you know, material that's safe. It won't harm birds or other wildlife, and it is effective at dispersing oil and keeping it from sticking to things. Cool. Again, we have to see if it actually all pans out, but the chemistry behind it seems to be solid. So good job, guys.
Thank you. Good work, Bob. I expect nothing less.
All right, Jay, do you have a quote for us?
I have an awesome quote this week. This quote was sent in by a listener from London named Kau Matawera, and I'm really sorry if I mispronounce your name. K-A-I-O. Kau. Anyway, thank you for sending in the quote. And this week's quote is, "Hence the ways of men part. If you wish to strive for peace of soul and pleasure, then believe. If you wish to be a devotee of truth, then inquire." Any guesses?
Wink Martindale?
It was Friedrich Nietzsche.
Do you agree with that quote, Jay?
No, he doesn't.
Not 100%. Like, I get what he was saying. I love the quote because it's poetic.
Yeah, it is poetic. And I mean, definitely the second half. If you wish to be a devotee of truth, then inquire. And it's truth of the small t, which is important. There is no truth of the big T. So, yeah, that's I buy that.
It doesn't exclude the idea that you could be an intellect and be a critical thinker and also not be able to be peaceful or happy. It's a very good quote, though. And that guy had one hell of a mustache.
Yeah, he was working it. Well, next weekend we will be in Atlanta at Dragon Con.
Yep. Woohoo!
Rebecca, did we sell out for the private show?
No, actually we have 5 tickets left.
Just five
tickets left. Yes. Go to skepticalrobot.com to get them.
Ooh, grab them while you can.
They're hot.
Also, if anybody's at Dragon Con, go to the parade and look for the skeleton pirate. I think I'll be towards the end.
Oh yeah. I remember him from 3 years ago.
This is new and improved. This is version 3.0, new and improved.
Well, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
You're welcome.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
Very good science fiction this week. Yeah, you're welcome.
It was awesome.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.